Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Brian. I did not attend the Falcon Heavy launch, Brushwood.
No, that's my gimmick. I'm the guy who does not drop. Actually, I'm really glad I didn't go because it turned out that the schedule I was doing, I would have had the miserable experience of being there with you, getting antsy, having to leave like minutes before it going off. So it was pushed.
Because of your choices. And, Justin does not care about SpaceX, the future frontier, Robert Young.
What did I say before we started going live?
For those of guys who haven't listened to, or not here live, in the pre-show, Justin said, I know what this is going to be. It's going to be a big shaming. And with all the sincerity, I mean, one might suggest that you should not trust Andrew Main because he looked us dead in the eyes like, no, won't do that at all.
I knew this was coming. I got. Here's how giddy Andrew has been to rightly. By the way, let me come out.
By the way, our producer, by the way, is Bryce
rightly,
did not attend.
Rightly shamed.
Did not attend. I watched. I did watch it. I did have to skip back because I was showering when it happened. But
yeah, and speaking of which, I think in our defense, I can't know because I wasn't there and you were there, but I gotta tell you, it was a hell of a show watching that whole thing live streamed. It was electric and deeply meaningful to me. Definitely got choked up. I mean, it was amazing.
I'm just saying that Andrew was so excited to shame us here on the program that he was bragging to mutual friends about how much he was going to shame us on the Weird Things podcast that got back to me. So I knew that this was coming. I knew that no matter what that box looked like, there was going to be a novelty punching fist inside of it. And by the way, let me just say again, correctly so, because in watching that clip, if I could have bent space and time and done everything, made everything work, I would have been there. It was an amazing thing to watch in a digital medium. But let's go ahead and clear the floor so Andrew can correctly and rightly explain the magnitude of such beauty.
And let me say, I mean, it's we all live complicated lives and we have to make choices, and I get that, and I totally get that. And I didn't watch Super Bowl Sunday, right? And I'm weird for that. Like, I didn't watch it because I'm like, every year it's another one. You know, I don't watch it. I get it. But I'm not like, oh, people, it's a Super Bowl, it's a dumb thing. No, I've watched it before and enjoyed it. But I'm just not, it's not my thing. And so I'm not like, oh, it's easy, it's doing this. But like, I didn't care, you know, Academy Awards, Oscars, stuff like that. Don't matter. Don't really matter to me. I have my own things that I'm really, really into.
Of those things, I found that my interest is directly proportional to the number of people around me who are into it. Like, you know, their enthusiasm can rub off on me and I can get excited about it. But something like this, just inherent, like there's a magnetism from your heart drawing you into this thing.
Yeah, I've had on my phone for 3 years since they first released the animation of the Falcon Heavy, which is beautiful to watch the actual thing and look as I hold up my phone and that's the animation of it. I've had this on my phone.
Yeah.
Right. Cause then I told myself I've been to most of the major SpaceX launches. Justin and I've been to a couple of them and I've told myself, I was going to go to this launch. It's going to the Falcon Heavy. Cause for me as a space fan, as a guy who like I'm, you know, I eat this stuff up all day long. I'm like, I need to be there for this. I need to be there. And so once we had confirmation of the date when it was going to be, I went ahead, booked myself a ticket, first class ticket. I had to go there, you know, that way style.
Oh my God. Of course. If you're going to do the insane thing of going across the country to watch a rocket, you want everything. It's worth it to splurge it to make sure you just remember all the joy in the world. That's amazing.
Now, they had ticket packages where you could get what was called Feel the Heat, which was the closest package you could. And they're like, $150 a piece. I was about, I'm like, man, I should get like one or two of those. Mike, well, I'll just wait for Justin and Brian to tell me what they're doing.
Oh, but we didn't.
Yeah.
And then we didn't.
So I didn't get that. I didn't get to see, because I'm like, I didn't want to just get myself one. And then if you guys couldn't do it, then realize I needed to get another package. So I ended up getting what was called close. It was close enough because your friends, you know, were debating whether or not to go. So I got the close enough package, you know.
Justin, I think we need to apologize.
There.
I'm sorry that we totally ruined your Falcon Heavy once-in-a-lifetime viewing experience.
It was great. I mean, I genuinely waited to order those because I was waiting to hear what my buddies were like, yeah, we're going to go do this thing we're going to do. It's fine.
Yeah.
It's good. I saw it in a pretty good spot. And there's a building, you know, the little obstruction and stuff there. But it's fine.
I apologize. I would like to just go ahead and say I personally apologize for making this lesser.
Yeah, I appreciate the apology accepted. So anyhow, I went there anyways. I watched it from the Rocket Garden. Okay, the Rocket Garden at Kennedy Space Center Visitor Complex. And if you've never been there, it's really amazing. They've got all these different rockets on display, actual rockets that they used in the Gemini program, that they used in the Mercury program, historic spacecraft things. You can actually go stick your head inside of some of them, some of like the demonstration ones, whatever. It was a really, really cool location to do this. There's a graphic up there of this. It's just amazing. Then they had a big video screen set up. You were able to bring your chair. So I went there with my producing partner, Mary Jarris. You guys all know Mary. Mm-hmm. And so Mary's a big SpaceX fan too. I said, hey, do you want to go? She's like, yeah, let's go. So we all went to go see this thing. And I got chairs at Walmart the night before. Almost all the chairs were gone, right? But I found two camping chairs. We brought those up, set those up in the grass, and then we walked around and did the – was amazing was Kennedy Space Center was sold out. But you had access to the exhibits, but everybody was out there on the lawn waiting for the launch. But, you know, having done launches before, I know, like, you know, it's a couple hours of nothing happening.
Yeah.
So we parked our chairs there and we went around and we did the exhibits. There was like nobody in the exhibits.
Oh, that's great. So there's no lines. That's the way it was. We went to the zoo on Christmas Eve, or maybe it was the day before Christmas Eve. And there was no lines for anything. I went up and fed giraffes and rode camels. It was amazing.
Yeah, but like the center was full, but there was a merch line for Falcon, you know, for SpaceX stuff. It was long, but everybody's like staying around the you know, the monitor because like, oh, we don't want to miss this. Like the line to get into this thing was huge, and I got a kind of a neat aside about that. And let me give you just the backup. We're driving to the Kennedy Space Center complex, and I know how long it takes. Or I've done like press access stuff before there and all that. You have to go through security at that point. Like at a certain point, that we'd have to do that. But I have a pass here that I had to use to actually get through. Into there because it's, you know, the Space Center is closed off to everybody unless you have, you know, you bought a ticket for that or whatever. As we're driving through Cape Canaveral, which is, you know, a bunch, if you've ever been there, it's like it's in a swamp. It's a swamp with a bunch of rocket pads at one end, some buildings, and then roads connecting them. Then it's just swamp for the rest of it. We're driving along and
like maybe like one Burger King. There's like a
not on Cape Canaveral itself. On the complex itself, it's just government buildings or space center. Yeah. So on that island, yeah, it's just all that. You go down to Merritt Island, it's different, but up in the complex, it's not. So because again, they secure the island when they do the launches. It's a danger zone, et cetera. So now we're driving along through the road, the Axis Space Center Highway Road, whatever. Turn a corner, look out over to my right. I'm like, huh? I'd heard this was here. I didn't realize this was here, and it was this state. The Blue Origin Assembly Facility.
Oh.
And if you type in Blue Origin Cape Canaveral, this thing is huge. And this is not the factory in Alabama where they're building stuff, but this is going to be where they're going to be putting together and doing their stuff. And it's got – there's like a separate building, which is probably looks like where they store their chemical fuel storage, whatever. It's a big IKEA-sized thing.
It's been a hot minute since we've talked about Blue Origin's strategy, partly because, you know, SpaceX has been hogging up all the news. But Blue Origin is still heavily invested in the single stage to orbit, right? Or is it
not? No, they're moving towards – they're going to be doing – I mean, they have a single stage. It won't be single stage to orbit, okay? It's going to be just single stage to space – which is their the new Shepard. But what they're working on, their next-gen rocket's the new Glenn, which will be a two-stage rocket, and that'll be an orbital class. New Shepard, for named for Alan Shepard, our first American to go into space, which he went past the Kármán line.
Oh, got it. Whereas Glenn was the first to orbit.
Yeah, exactly. John Glenn first to orbit. So they're going to have the next rocket they're building is going to – and they're using their own engines. They're building the BE-4 engines. That's their next generation engines that they're working on. So they're doing what I think is the right thing, and that is building their own engines in order to do this, because they're building methane too. And it's obviously we're SpaceX fanboys here, but we're space fanboys overall. And I think we're going to see some exciting stuff come out of Blue Origin, because remember, Bezos is the richest man in the world, and he's putting over $1 billion a year into Blue Origin. He's got some brilliant talent there. So we're going to see some cool stuff from them too. So watching what's going on with his rockets there, and they're going to do the same thing, land the boosters back on Kennedy or land them wherever. They're also building the BE-4 engines for a ULA rocket, the Vulcan. So they're actually going to become a supplier of rocket engines to other companies.
Wild.
So then doing drone – remember there was the whole thing about doing the whole barge landing, because Blue Origin had actually filed a patent for that. And then SpaceX contested that because they said, hey, this is prior art, whatever. And that was one of the things where, hey, it's a great competition. I was like, yeah, but here's kind of this sort of little thing of Blue Origin maybe looking doesn't – and they didn't look good in those optics.
For chewing out, saying we have the patent on it, and then you're like, yeah, but you're also not capable of doing it yet. So
there was a nice friendly
As settlement, here, have a Tesla if you can get it.
Exactly. So it seemed as resolved a bit. Jeff Bezos had a very nice tweet he sent out last week, wishing success to SpaceX and the Falcon Heavy launch. Elon Musk responded with a emoji kissing, and so this is where we want this to be. I want to go to SpaceX launches and cheer them on. I want Blue Origin to be doing some cool stuff and be excited about that. We want this is where it wants to be. I was excited to see that.
Quick side jag here. This is what it felt like in the 1800s, the so-called robber barons, the captains of industry were changing the rules for steel and the golden spike that linked the two sides of the United States, the continental U.S. As a kid, I wondered how must that have felt. And I get to know that now. These are the guys that 100 years from now will still have their names sung or cursed for generations.
They'll probably still be alive, given their push for
yeah, exactly.
Could be. But it's a special thing to realize, like we are experiencing real life history.
Yeah, it's cool. So we go do the tour of the Kennedy Space Center complex, and have you ever gone? You've done that before?
Not Kennedy. I've done. I did Space Center Houston, and
so what's cool about Kennedy is they have the Space Shuttle Atlantis there, right? And they have this exhibit where you go through, and it's very they revamped this thing over the last 10 years, decade or so, theme park level, and I mean in a good way. It went from sort of this kind of like there's a science museum approach to doing some things, which sometimes doesn't work, or it's kind of like okay, and then they kind of did this let's increase the level. So they have an Atlantis attraction where you walk through, you go see this amazing. They have a specially presented movie about kind of this a version of the story of how the reusable shuttle idea came about and whatnot there. We have actors playing out parts, and you go into another section, and then you go into this room, this big round-shaped room with these round screens all around you. And then you watch a shuttle take off and launch up into the air, which is amazing. And then at the end of that, you're like built up, like, this is an amazing thing. Look what we've done as humans. Isn't this amazing? You're like, yeah. And then that screen that you've been watching this on slides up. And that view you just saw of the Space Shuttle Atlantis is right in front of you.
That's brilliant. That's awesome. That's good storytelling right there.
Yeah, it is absolutely. As soon as it opened up, I just started grabbing photos. I'm like, oh, that's brilliant. Because, if you go to the one here in California, it's like, yep, there it is.
Over in the corner.
Like, oh, yeah, cool. Yeah, it's great. So here you're like, oh, my God, it's the Atlantis. Best part, though, was before we went into the exhibit, they had a super nice Space Center, I don't know what they call their docent guide or whatever, who was talking to us and explaining the one who, like, because they let a certain amount of people at a time, giving us the a spiel.
Oh, and keep in mind, this is a tour guide who
They're
always these guys are always having new groups. There's always something launching. Today it's another Iridium satellite. This one's going to monitor the weather. There's this. You know, you glance at it so that you can mention
it. Giving everybody some color of one of what's around, the things that are going around, describing some of the different companies here building stuff. Everything he said was wrong. Said was wrong. It was funny. I mean, it was just he was confusing ULA with OneWeb and these things, all this other stuff like this. Everything he said was wrong. It was fine. The best part was he was a very sweet, sweet man. Okay, but the best part is he goes, so yeah, SpaceX today is launching the Falcon Heavy, and they're sending up a car from Tulsa. And I'm like, I don't think the fat. Oh, Tesla.
Oh, no.
I'm like, it's a car from Tulsa. And I had the same reaction, like, beep. Tesla. Launching a car from Tulsa. So. Yeah, some random guy. They just took his car, you know. So anyhow, he went away, and there's this woman with her daughter. She had a daughter who's really into space science. The girl was like, you know, was on the spectrum, so she had some communications. But she loved space. Was there to see this, and she saw the exchange. This the looks I gave to Mary, and then she said to me, says, "Could you explain to me what's going on? Because I don't think that guy knew."
That's amazing.
Again, what he said, though, was his enthusiasm was there, and he was making a point. We did say, he's like, hey, listen, we've all these businessmen here. Everybody's buying up the land. Big things are coming there. So it was exciting. So that was the preamble to the launch, to go watch this. You're there with thousands of people who are super space fans. Some of them are SpaceX fans. Some of them are just space enthusiasts and stuff. You know, I saw a six-year-old kid and his grandmother both wearing Occupy Mars shirts.
That's awesome.
That's great.
You're seeing people running around in space. It was like it's like a college football game. You know, it was like, but SpaceX was the team. So it was a very, very exciting thing to be there. And so if you saw the launch, I don't need to recap what happened in the launch itself. I'll tell you what was really cool, though, being there, watching this on the screen and being we were 7 miles away from the launch was. You have the thing where you see it on TV start to launch, and the timing was super close. I've watched launches before where the delay was like 30 seconds, and you're waiting for the countdown, like 5, 4, or like time delay. But anyhow, the thing launches, and a few moments later, you look out and you see the flame, and you see the rocket rising up into the beautiful blue sky, and then you get the noise, and then the rumble. You feel it in your chest, you know.
Yeah.
There were 27 Merlin engines going off. 27 engines. Now, what was important about this launch was that is the most number of engines like ever used outside of the Russians had experimented with a rocket system that used 42, and it was very problematic. They had ignition problems, things like this. So there was a debate as to whether or not the 27 engines, you know, 27 engines like Elon Musk, you've gone too far. This was a rocket that Musk proposed way back in like 2012. And it kept getting delayed. You know, it wasn't these things like, oh, I'll be ready in this year. In 6 months, we'll do the launch. No, we won't. We'll be this time. No, we won't. And people started to say, is it going to happen? And the thing with Musk is his deadlines tend to slip. But when he delivers, man, does he deliver.
Yeah.
NASA had been approached before about using this rocket. And internally, the story is there. They're like, man, it's never going to happen. It's not going to happen. And then there was this 27 rocket engines trying to simultaneously ignite that. When you look at other rockets that are like three cores, whatever, they're usually like a single engine per that. Remember the shuttle, when that took off, it had two solid rocket boosters with one, you know, one engine on each one. And then the shuttle itself, main engines were three engines. Saturn V was five, you know. I mean, it was just unheard of idea of using this 27 engine thing. But, you know, the Musk mentality, as he describes it, like computer servers, says that, you know, I can have on the Falcon 9, I have nine engines, like I think two or three engines can go out and the thing still works.
Yeah.
Here, when they want to do the BFR, the Big Falcon spaceship, which they're going to start production on into this year and probably try to, he says they want to help test launch this into next year. 31 engines, but now that he's done 27 engines.
Yeah, now it doesn't seem so crazy.
Right.
So yeah, so we watch, you see the thing rise up, and now you're looking at the rocket and you're watching this thing, and everybody there has been, because you hear like, you know, I give it a 50-50 chance of success, you know, I don't want to destroy the launch pad. If I cannot destroy this historic launch pad, I'll be very, very happy. So you're kind of like, ready to be like, hear a boom and be like, hey guys, they gave it a good show. Good thing we tried. Let humanity is just pushing it forward, you know. See you next time. Anyways, launch. And then I'll just one more point, more live mode about is after you see that, you see the separation. And then a few minutes later, you're watching the screen, but it's blue. You can't see anything. And all of a sudden, you see two little bright fires light up in the sky. And that's when the boosters are doing their boost back burn. And then a little while later, you see two tiny slivers of white, and you're looking up in the sky, and you're seeing the boosters come back. Now, we'll forget the fact that once that boost back starts, you're having basically two nine-story tall guided missiles are heading in your direction.
And that's something I didn't consider. That's amazing.
We're basically in that target. It's basically coming right back at us, you know. And there's like before the launch, by the way, they read out an announcement that says, hey, just ladies and gentlemen, just a detail, you are inside of a hazardous area, and in the event of an explosion or whatever like that, please don't panic, please don't do this. I mean, it's this whole disclaimer about like, yeah, listen, if it hits the Shan, we don't want screaming around and panicking, you know. Like, and everybody's gonna laugh at that. I'm like, yeah, remember, there's the map, that thing goes boom, it'll be loud. So you see the boosters coming, finally come, you see this falling, and you're watching them, you see them on the monitor, you see that screen, but then you look up live and you just see these things falling from space. And as a kid, I still have these day to this day, I'd have dreams about watching like cool spacecraft and stuff way high up doing like cool maneuvers and stuff and hovering and landing, and you're watching these things just fall from space, and you're like, holy cow, you see things plummeting, like, how are they going to stop? And then you see the ignition burn and they go behind some trees, and then you watch on the screen as boom, the simultaneous landing and release.
Dude,
there you go.
So now we get to the part where I have a very mild conspiracy theory. And regardless, they knocked it out of the park. It occurs to me, however, that when a company announces their quarterly earnings report, they are direct and honest, but they want to help guide expectations beforehand. So they very publicly say, we're hoping this quarter will be so-and-so or whatever. But then there are secret whisper numbers that usually leak out and people are aware. So maybe they'll announce, yep, we hit all of our targets. Here's the actual amount we made. And the stock will go down because that number is lower than the whisper number, right? SpaceX is an extraordinarily media-savvy company. And I, just as a flight of fancy, could imagine that the whisper numbers are, yeah, we feel really good about getting to orbit. I'd say the odds are 99%. I think we feel really good about landing the two strapped on boosters. Those are, well, let's put that at 95% that both of them will land, no problem. This drone one, I'm going to say there's a 50% chance, Elon, that it might miss the drone. We're worried about this. This is the least tested of the three. Would you like us to arrange for some interference on the live stream from the drone? Because that's the only thing that went off without a hook. It feels to me like it wouldn't be a bad deal for someone to say, yeah, let the media crew know that that connection might be a bit sketchy and that we might lose it due to vibrations, and have this finger on the trigger. And if it doesn't look like it's going to go right, just press pause. And we'll have a very short blackout, and then because the story, I mean, they threaded the stone needle. Not only did they do it, but they did it in such a perfect way that that the one part of it that didn't hit exactly perfectly right, there's no footage of it. At which, to me, would be the even smarter, better version of SpaceX to plan for that. Is that out of the question? Am I just crazy?
You know, only a handful of people really know. I would say that the evidence I would offer, like, one, like, they were 99% sure that they were not going to have a rocket explode on the launch pad from fueling.
Right.
And that happened. They were very positive they weren't the first explosion, that the steel strut they were using wasn't going to break in there. And so, you know, for Elon Musk's point of view is there, everybody can say, yeah, these are the things, we think it looks good, but there are all these unknowns, and then there's 1,000 things that can go wrong. I deal with this, like, I have a project, which we'll talk about later on. People are like, oh, I should use safe and all this. I'm like, yeah, but I can tell you 12 things that are a problem that I have to worry about that you, unless you know what's going on, you don't really realize, like, oh, yeah, that's a problem. So I think his concern was just based upon past times when, like, yeah, we thought we were right on this. When they finally did the landing on land, they were seemed pretty confident, like, yeah, we think we got this, because they went through all the different kinds of explosions, things that could go wrong, they could do this. As far as cutting the live feed, you know, because they knew there was a high chance that was not going to make, maybe. I mean, you'd have to ask, like, okay, did they know it wasn't going to make it? Because they could have just said, you know, well, we're just going to dump that in the ocean, whatever. The problem is that if you've watched past ones, the live feed almost always, very frequently, cuts out before the landing on the drone ship, because the rocket comes in with so much vibration, you have to use a directional satellite antenna, and it knocks it out of alignment.
Got it.
And that's been a problem. We've seen this before where they've done it where it keeps getting knocked out of alignment, and then finally, you know, they get signal again, and then you see it there standing. There's been a number of launches where it just goes blank at that point. You're like, what happened? And then it cuts to it, and there's the rocket standing there.
In my imagination, there's like a hard-nosed PR lady who kicks the door in to the live stream crew and says, you know, tomorrow morning when the news hits, we do not see a crashing drone. You understand?
Or I mean, but that's the thing, though, is that, like, gigantic fireball, you know, conflagration crashes has kind of also been a part of their brand.
Sure. But like, at a place where they already have the massive success, you know that they're not going to show the two landing perfectly if they have the option to show the one blowing up the next day. Like, they're not going to run the two over the other, the two successes over the one failure.
Yeah, I hear your point. It's not outside the realm of possibility. You know, they're extremely transparent, but they want to be transparent in a way that they can control. So I think it is what it is. But your suggestion there, I'm not gonna, like, no, Brian.
And again,
$1 billion company at the whim of investors and assets would never do that.
to be clear, I have no dog in the fight and zero evidence to back up my theory. Yeah. It just seems to me like everything about it went so perfectly,
well,
including. Including that moment. That's the only one that is so, I'm so glad. Like, here's the point. I found myself as a SpaceX fan so glad that the internet went out. That, like, what a wonderful, happy coincidence that kept the focus of the news cycle on the successes, because there was no exciting footage of the disaster part. And it was such an important part of it that it just occurs to me that if somebody was savvy and direct enough, that maybe, you know, maybe a happy accident isn't just an accident.
Well, and I was feeling kind of similar on the day of the launch, because we saw the feed freeze up, which is pretty standard. I don't know that I've ever watched one of these live ones and actually seen
everything
drone
go perfectly.
Ship footage, yeah, come in live.
Yeah.
But you would also think, hey, they can't get another boat out there.
Yeah.
but also, like, it took a while for the confirmation that core was lost to come out, which was kind of a bummer. You know, you want all this stuff to succeed, but equally it took a minute for that to come out, and
yeah.
I didn't even see it on the official SpaceX feeds. It was from someone else.
That's the other thing too, is they're so savvy in that they didn't start the live feed until they were very close to launch, and then the moment they were done, they stopped
right
everything
off.
Because
yeah.
they realized that yes, this is a live stream, but the beginning and the end are going to be what you know, this is going to live. More people are going to watch it offline than online. And so as a result, they kept it super tight, this 35-minute package.
Yes, Dan, but remember, there was a five-hour live stream that started.
Oh, there was? They had a separate one?
Starman.
Yes, of course.
So they started a live stream because once, remember the payload now, they had the Falcon, they had the Roadster strapped to the upper stage. And this last minute revelation was that because they're sending, here they are sending the Falcon, you know, they're sending the Roadster with Starman, you know, their SpaceX mannequin put attached in there with all the inside jokes there, which we can talk about. They were sending this on an orbit to take it past the orbit of, you know, the orbit of Mars. But because part of what they want to do with the Falcon Heavy is they want to be able to do Air Force launches. The Air Force, to be fully capable of handling all the Air Force requirements for launch, there are about like 9 different orbits you have to have. You can have, you know, a regular equatorial orbit, kind of you can do it like the International Space Station does. You're in low Earth orbit, got 200 miles up. You can have polar orbits. There are geosynchronous orbits. There's like, I think, roughly like 9 different positions the Air Force says, if you can do this, you're fully qualified to handle our different payloads. So what big part of some of those, the more tricky ones, you need a lot of energy. You need a lot of energy. It's not how much you can carry, but it's how much energy you can do to get to that orbit. And you have to spend some of them like 5 hours or more going through the Van Allen radiation belts. That's that belt filled with these highly charged particles that can screw things up. We send our astronauts through there very quickly so they don't get irradiated, et cetera. So they spent 5 hours sending the upper stage through there, hoping it didn't fry the electronics before it did its burn to go into its extreme orbit it had. So while they did this, they were able, while it was in Earth orbit for that 5 hours, they were able to transmit signal. They had a battery for like a 12-hour battery, whatever, on there for transmitting. They sent back these live images of views of the car, the views from the passenger area. I mean, the views of this amazing views of an object that's much further away from the Earth than usually we're accustomed to, way further out than the ISS goes, whatever. This is further than any human has been
since the example,
you know, 1970s.
The example that I remember reading when James Cameron edited an issue of Wired magazine, he pointed out that after the lunar missions, no human being has ever seen Earth in its totality. He described the view from the ISS as the equivalent of putting your cheek on a basketball, and you know, you're up there, you can see a lot, but it's like you can't take in the totality of all of Earth at once. And so this is phenomenal. Yeah, he said, and I remember the line he said: since the lunar missions, not one man, and he did comma, and never a single woman has beheld all of Earth in its totality at once. And it's like, mm-hmm. I'm so excited that I'm going to live to hear that made false. That's amazing.
Yeah. So the Starman images are wonderful. They're great. It's great publicity. It's great media. It's understanding. It's great showmanship. It was actually doing a real purpose, real. They needed to do an actual payload. Did you know, have you heard the statistics on the SpaceX Live YouTube feed?
No, but I know that waiting before it even started, there were nearly 1 million people waiting in a room with no live stream. It was amazing.
Second most watched live stream ever.
Is that? Wow. Can I guess that the first Felix Baumgarten?
That was it.
Yeah.
Stratos jump. Number one, that. Number two is this. Okay, now this has racked up a total of 19 million views so far. Number one most watched live event ever. And you look at the plays of Starman now. If you look to the right, you're going to see people are doing a lot of mix-ups of that. You know, we've had some of our fans or some of our friends of the show who are teachers and stuff had their kids watch this in class. And you're a kid, you don't get space, don't care, whatever. You see this car and this mannequin astronaut there in front of Earth, and you're like, this is live. This is a thing real right now. You're like, oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
I mean, this to me was the realization of the greenhouse on Mars. You know, this is, you know, when Elon Musk talks about, you know, the initial idea of the greenhouse on Mars being about stakes, right? And the idea was that would be the furthest that you could show, furthest away from Earth that you could grow Earth life, right? There that anything living had been from our planet. And this was, to me, exactly that idea of like, look at something that is compelling and interesting, and yet, like you guys have pointed out, so scientifically relevant and so promising for the future. And if, you know, Elon Musk's initial idea for SpaceX was literally just to get the public more behind space, then hell, I mean, like look at what we've done.
Yeah. And it was being there was a huge event. They had like 10 or 20 times as much press as they normally get. When I checked into my hotel, I hear this voice coming from the bar, which there was like people still there talking, even though it was after closed. And I hear, well, the thing about space that's and it's Bill Nye, the Science Guy,
you know,
explaining to people that he's a gentleman and an explainer and a kind-hearted man. So, but anyhow, it was felt big being there, right? Getting back to the airport 2 days later, getting on the plane, I saw, and there was way, I can only imagine it was like the day before, but getting back on the plane to go back to LA, lots of SpaceX gear everywhere, right? It was like after a college football game, people were returning home, whatever, with enthusiasm. The thing that surprised me, and again, I'm there in the middle of it though, was the reaction has been so wonderfully positive. Yes, stupid people on social media have said things. This is the world we live in. Somebody somewhere will say something stupid. You're going to get these stupid things people say, and people who are just like, man, rich guy put in his car in space. All right, next. I've read editorials across the political spectrum cheering on what happened. Reasonable people of all sort of approaches got it. It excited people. And I was blown away by how much attention this has gotten. I've been blown away by the positive reaction that it has received, and I'm thrilled to see that. It gives me hope, because we've talked about when will people get excited about people, when will people pay attention? People paid attention to this launch, and technically it's just a hardware demo. There's no people involved, whatever. When SpaceX does the next major thing, which will be when they start putting first unmanned the crew capsule up there to test that, and then when finally maybe into this year, probably more like next year, when SpaceX and Boeing are putting actual astronauts back into American hardware, okay, the first time we'll have had people go up on American spacecraft since like 2011, the first new craft to go into space, this will be the first new craft that people will be on board in 40 years. You know, the first shuttle was 1981. So by next year or so, it'll be almost 40 years since then. So think about the first new spacecraft in 40 years. Kind of awesome.
I mean, look, here's what I think changed over the last week is that previously a lot of space arguments were very theoretical. It was very for the majority of people. Obviously, we've been kind of very closely following step by step the progress of a lot of these companies, including SpaceX. But for most people, it was kind of how many angels can dance on the head of a pin. And I think that it should be NASA. And I think it should be this. And I think it should be that.
Justin,
but nobody really paid that much attention to it until you see it in action. And you're like, wait, this is not a theoretical, maybe they'll do it, maybe they won't, maybe they should focus on tourism first. This is done. It's happened. It's ready to go. So now the question is, how do we want to use it? And that, to me, from the like super NASA fans who, for whatever reason, believe that SpaceX is the enemy, to the hardcore libertarians there or whatever that I don't know, put a political bent on it, but people who believe that Elon Musk is some tax cheat or something, like
welfare queen.
Welfare queen, exactly. When you look at that, it's like, oh, crap. This is real. This is something that can be sold. This is something that we can use. So now the far more interesting question isn't if, it's what we do with it.
Justin, you were very sweet to couch this so politely, but I think it's very clear what you guys are asking for.
Yeah.
I'm sorry I was wrong for saying we should build a space elevator. Clearly, reusable rockets were the right answer. You guys were right, and I was wrong.
If we
finally!
We would have had that audio. We would have had that. If we were a better show, we would have pulled that audio of the space elevator argument.
I was wrong. You were right.
But I will reiterate though that the until Elon Musk, and it was think National Press Club 2011, stood there in front of his podium and said, "Hey, yeah, we're working towards reusability with, you know, boosters and the whole rocket. We're working towards this thing. We've done the math and it's possible." I didn't know this was like a thing that could be done. And apparently a lot of other people didn't, because they told him, "No, you're not going to be able to reuse the first stage. NASA would have done, literally, if it could be done, NASA would have done that, you know, would have been done. We'd be doing it. It's not happened, you know." And then they're like, "Ah, yeah, maybe you could do it, but there's really not a cost benefit. Hey, guess what? We just knocked $20 million off the price of launch. It's a gimmick. It's a gimmick." You know, now every space agency now is working towards trying to figure out their own reusable rocket, because they're like, you know, we kind of was like Apple and the iPhone and all the cell phone companies. You know, they're like, "Yeah, these PC guys are going to come in here and make a phone." You know, what do they know?
Right.
Turns out a lot.
So, two big questions is, how fast do you think we start to see the trickle down effects of reusability and the cost reduction? Number two, how far off do you think the next functional launch of the Falcon Heavy is?
One is now. There are already launch customers that are getting discounts for using reusable rockets. That has already affected the price of that. Now, if you go to reddit.com/r/SpaceX, they have a launch manifest, and in the right corner, they will show you the upcoming launches, and you'll see the recycled symbol, which means they're reusing a booster from before. Okay.
Oh, wow.
Now, what they're doing right now is that they have the boosters they're reusing. He's actually cleaning out the inventory of these things, because like right now, a lot of those are not reusing them because they don't need those, because they're working on the end of a few more months, whatever, towards the end of the year, they're going to finish the basic version of the Falcon 9, which would be the Block 5 variant. Block 5 is the version of the Falcon 9 that they're building, taking in everything they've learned about reusability. What do they need to do internally? What do they do externally? How do they make this thing reusable? So once they have Block 5, those are going to be the boosters they're going to keep using and using forever. They want to get like 10 uses out of those, I think is what they're trying to do. So instead of having to build one rocket, you know, building 10 rockets, you know, for 10 launches, you build one rocket for 10 launches of the lower stage. So that will bring in costing. Now, right now they're trying to recoup their investment costs and stuff, but there has been a reflection. Elon tweeted out today, the price of a Falcon Heavy launch in comparison to the Delta IV Heavy, which has been prior to this was the big heavy lift you used. And the Delta IV is a $400 million launch cost. Falcon Heavy is $150 million. And wow. It also has something like double the payload or something like this. And that's fully expendable, by the way. That's if you're not reusing the Falcon. That's if the Falcon, if you're dumping the first stages into the ocean, okay. If you're reusing it, you know, it might come down. I think it's going to come to like $80 million or $90 million or something like that. So you have $400 million is how much you paid before. Now you can pay, using reusable, you can pay $100 million. I'm not a math guy. That is how much the government paid for those things. When I watched an Orion launch, when I've watched these payload things, $500 million. Okay, now you're getting a substantial change. What's very disruptive now is we've talked about the SLS program. Okay, this is the big, huge, heavy lift thing, which is, you know, and it's the like people
the,
like
oh, the
you
SLS know, it's twice is as basically powerful. The successor to the shuttle. Basically, the government.
Yeah, it's designed to be our preeminent heavy lift vehicle. It uses shuttle technology and Saturn V tech. It's full. It's not reusable. Like, oh, it's the next. It's a successor to the shuttle. It's not reusable. Like, well, it could be, but it's not. It's like, oh, you could maybe reuse the side boosters. There's no plan to do that. We've spent about $20 billion on that so far. They plan to spend right now they're spending about $2 billion every year on the development of this thing. $2 billion a year. And when this thing is finally ready, it will cost over $1 billion a launch. Be like, well, it's more powerful than the Falcon Heavy. It's like, yeah, in the biggest configuration, it's really more. It's, you know, NASA's like, we can carry 134 elephants. They can only carry 100. You know, it's like, so those extra 34 elephants cost us $800 million.
So, do you think that this is just going to continue because of the sunk cost fallacy? Like, we've spent this much on it. There's too much political capital tied up in it. And
Ted Cruz pretty much made that argument. He says, like, you know, I know there's a sunk cost fallacy, but, you know, we've talked about, I think, you know, we've talked about that. Or actually, no, that was made about the International Space Station, which is another thing to bring up. Yes, that is the problem. There is the sunk cost fallacy. We paid this much to get this far. And that's the problem. It's people like, why would we not? Which is, as we know, is dangerous. It's and you hear that all the time in government. We put this much so far, and it's not just sunk cost. It's also, if we change it, then we admit that we wasted your $20 billion.
And that's ultimately the issue politically, as I put on my political analyst
hat. Yeah.
You don't want to have, when you're going for re-election, you don't want the black and white ad of Ted Cruz wasted over bleep, blop, bloop. After he abandoned his plan for space, you know, that's what you are guarding against, which sometimes, you know, don't want to make any political waves here, but sometimes does not lead to the most efficient creation of very delicate programs like space launch and exploration.
So there was there's a great talk. Robert Zubrin, who is, you know, speaks his own mind. He is, you know, certainly an expert. He was the guy that came with the Mars Direct mission, whatnot. He's, you know, knows Elon. He's been part of, you know, commenting on what they've been done, is very supportive in some ways, has his own ideas on how we should go to Mars and all that. But he was on Coast to Coast AM, and they asked him about this. And he was, you know, extremely jubilant about what's been done here and the potential for the Falcon Heavy. And he brought up a point. There was a thing called the Augustine Commission, which is like back in like 2011, where they were talking about a, you know, what would it take to go to, you know, to do a build, you know, like a moon mission, like a return to the moon or whatever like this. What are the costs and all that? And they said to build a new, like a new heavy lift rocket for this capability to do this, what we need. They said, you know, we're going to need, you know, they said we're going to need like 20 years and $60 billion. He says is what it would cost, like 20 years and $60 billion. And Elon Musk brought up the Falcon Heavy and they said they laughed at him. They're like, no, that's not realistic. You're not going to be able to do that. And this was a government commission to judge the feasibility. This must like, what if we did, you know, we could do this. We, you know, we could, I could deliver it to you for $2 billion. They're like, no, you couldn't. No, sorry. Thank you. Get out of the room. And he just did it on his own dime.
It's truly remarkable. Too bad he's a huckster and a fraudster that's just out to swindle the government out of their money. Way to go, South Africa. You're sleeper agent.
Sheeple.
The old
booster to Mars scam, right? That's right after the short change and the big old book of cons.
I'm sad that I was so petty after the launch. I just tweeted, too bad we stopped dreaming.
if you support that kind of petty behavior, you can support us at patreon.com/weirdthings, which we probably could have done about 20 minutes ago, but we were so excited about SpaceX. Patreon.com/weirdthings. Support the show. Get the After Things show early. It's a great time. Let's go back to talking about SpaceX.
Now we have, let's talk about, we'll talk quickly, just talk, reiterate what's the future, what's next, okay?
Yeah.
Block five, and crew. Okay, crew is actually their big priority right now. They're, you know, keep perfecting the Falcon 9 for block five, and then what they're working now, block five means reusability, lowered cost, taking everything they've learned. Remember, the first Falcon rocket we watched launch is 50% less powerful than the rocket they have now. Or in that one we have now is 50% more powerful. They've increased these efficiencies. They've added reusability. They've done that. And the next big step, and the thing that keeps delayed, it's challenging, is to build the crew capsules. They'll be able to put people on there and make sure that we can give them safest ride into space you can. And there's a lot of challenges there because NASA has very stringent requirements. On one hand, people are like, well, you know, people died in Saturn missions. People died in shuttle missions. You know, maybe they're being unreasonable with their safety requests. The other argument is like, yeah, we don't want that to happen anymore.
Yeah. You know? And it's like, yeah, we are going to select the deluxe package, the first class trip in which very few people, possibly none, die. And so, yes, it will be more expensive.
So that's been – so Boeing's working on the Starliner and SpaceX is working, of course, on Crew Dragon. These things are taking, you know, time. And there was, you know, they were supposed to have, like, you know, a year ago maybe been doing the tests on these things. And so that's still in progress. But that will be the next big thing, will be Crew Dragon. And so that's the big thing we're looking forward to. Then Elon Musk said something that was very exciting, which it was hopeful Elon speak. So don't take it as he promised, like Elon Long promised this. No, he said he wants to do something at a certain point. Doesn't mean he promised that. He didn't like pinky swear, I'm going to deliver this to you, okay? What he's working on or said that they're going to try to do now is the BFR test, okay? The big Falcon rocket, which they're going to build in San Pedro. They're going to try – that's the plan right now, San Pedro, California, to the Port of Los Angeles. That's going to be their big assembly facility for this thing because it's huge. This thing will be the upper stage alone, 30 feet across, 150 feet tall, right? This is a thing
for,
that
for
looks
context,
like –
how much bigger is that than what we've seen from the Falcon 9 rockets and so on?
Bryce, pull up a size chart if you can. There's a really good comparison. Do like Falcon Heavy BFR comparisons in there. I think there's one that shows like the new Glenn. It's not just taller, it's broader, much, much wider. This is a thing that would go to Mars, could go to anywhere in the solar system with a solid surface.
As impressed as I was with the Falcon Heavy launch and as proud as I am, man, does the BFR give me shower intimidation.
Yeah.
It's a very big rocket.
So they have like the payload, how much payload it can carry. Like they show the Falcon Heavy can do 30 tons. The BFR in full reusability, 150 tons, okay?
Five times the payload. Wow.
And that's a rocket. And they're saying that's a rocket designed. That goes up, that booster lands, and they just start refueling the booster right away, okay? The spaceship goes up, does its cargo, does whatever, comes back down and lands. They refuel that. Funny thing. Elon Musk has said, hey, we think we could get the first stage to orbit by itself.
Wow.
Now, the problem is, I mean, there's no fuel to land the thing, but he says, yeah, I think I could get the first stage to orbit by itself, which you want to get a space station. This thing has about half the interior volume of the International Space Station.
Isn't that what they did with Skylab? Wasn't Skylab built inside of the fuel section?
Not a fuel tank, but it was a second stage.
Sure, but I mean, as long as you have a big empty vessel that can be pressurized and just throw a bunch of them up there, and you got a giant space casino.
There's a lot of problems trying to use fuel things as that, but yeah, there's you have the capability to throw stuff up there and carry a lot of heavy material. And so, you know, why the heck not? So you have cool proposals like if you look at Bigelow has their inflatable habitat modules. They have a thing called, if you look up, I think it's Bigelow Olympus. They already have a Bigelow. Those are the ones that go up. They attach it. They attach one to the International Space Station. They fill it with air and it expands and increases the interior volume, right? So they have one in space right now. They've tested this thing. So this is space tested technology. You could put one of these things inside a Falcon Heavy and you already have, you know, a thing that's much bigger than the amount of space we have in the International Space Station.
Man, okay? Space steading as a real thing.
Yeah.
So stay in your orbit long enough, it becomes yours. Get off my orbit.
So like, yeah, we have this capability now to be able to launch new space stations and stuff much more quickly, and what the technology we have, it's a very, very exciting period. But anyhow, so like he says that by the end of next year, again, so that's 2019, they hope to start testing. Remember how we watched the Grasshopper? Remember the Grasshopper testing, the Falcon 9? Remember the first time that video came out and people thought it was faked?
Yeah, it looked like they were playing it in reverse.
Yeah, like, yes, it's just a thing. It's not real. So anyhow, they plan on hopefully the end of next year start doing test hops, probably out of Brownsville, Texas, of the Big Falcon spaceship. And so that thing you saw there, that upper stage thing, we might be seeing that thing next year.
Wow.
Start testing.
Yeah, I'll make the trip down to Brownsville. Yep. I'll take a gander.
Brownsville, I'll do. Yeah. But exciting times.
Dude, I mean, look. If you're not paying attention when they put a car playing classic rock into the space and live stream it, like, you know, what are you going to pay attention to? I think that this did more. All right. I'm going to say something that it might be a little bit counterintuitive, but to me, it was the final acceptance of the you know, where SpaceX is and Elon Musk as a historical figure was when I started to see the, like, the personal backlash against Elon Musk of, like, you know, finding elements of his, you know, past marriages and stuff like that. And it's like, oh, who's this guy? And it's like, all right, if that's it, if the idea that mega successful CEO has been not the perfect husband is if that's where we're left to go, then tell you what,
I saw some of that backlash and I'm like, I want to be like, hey, wait until you find about the Nazi past of the guy that created our Saturn V program.
Oh yeah.
Hey, first rocket to put a man in space. Do you know where those blueprints came from?
Like, I mean, look, it's just, and everybody is entitled to feel however they want about anybody. And I know that there's obviously a Silicon Valley kind of backlash that is certainly in full swing in our modern culture. But boy, howdy, man, the hips don't lie, and neither do rockets.
yeah. So we're getting reports that, you know, the problem we have with the International Space Station is it has an end of life at like 2024 or whatever like that. That's the period at which they're saying, like, okay, there, we got to figure out what we're going to do with this. Are we going to put more money into the thing? It's reached its end of, like, it's, you know, the period at which it was sort of set out to do. And there are a couple options on the table. One is put a bunch more money into totally refitting it, keep it going, keep the thing, you know, going on continuously. Two is deorbit it, just do what they did with Mirror, which is like, hey, thanks, whatever, take apart the components, whatever, and just deorbit this thing into some place, let it burn up in the atmosphere and figure out what's next. The other option is let's just sell it off to some private enterprise and see if they want to take it over, what they want to do with it. And so right now it looks like the Trump administration is leaning towards the third one, which is like, let's see if private enterprise wants to take this thing over.
Makes sense. Like, we could put it on the yard sale. We're just going to, like, just put a price tag on it. OBO.
So here's the thing to consider. And when the reaction came out there was this outrage. Like, oh my God, I can't believe they're going to do it. Like, hey, number one, we had to figure out a plan for what we're going to do with this. Okay. It's not like all of a sudden he's like, hey, what's this thing up in space? What? You know, like, you know, let us sell it. It's like, no, it's like NASA has been working with this for decades to figure out what do you do at this point with this thing, because it ain't cheap. The budget for this, and actually Boeing has a contract to maintain it, by the way, is like $2 billion a year to maintain the International Space Station. Okay. It's $2 billion a year is the budget for that, whatever. I assume that's probably where they pay out for the support. You know, part of that goes through to, like, you know, for support, logistics, all this sort of stuff. I think that's what pays for the cargo supply routes, whatever. I think that's where it comes from. There's a $2 billion a year budget for this thing. Okay. I may be way wrong on that, but that's what I last remember reading. Okay. $2 billion a year to maintain this thing. Okay. Now, International Space Station is amazing. This thing's amazing. It's bigger than a football field. When you realize the size of this thing, you just sort of start to, you know, stare at it in awe. Although, if you look back at the image of the big Falcon spaceship next to it, you're like, maybe it's time we think bigger, because it kind of dwarfs the space station. The shuttle, look, and Elon Musk, he showed that image and people laughed because it realized how big the BFR compared to him. He's like, hey, the shuttle looked big too. The shuttle looked big too.
Yeah.
he's on thin ice there. So if you take that $2 billion a year, instead of putting it towards there, you say, let's build a new version. Because remember, that space station is great. Okay, now those solar panels, they're like 40% as efficient as the ones we have now, okay? These things, these modules are older. We know how to do things bigger and better now. We have new materials, new technology. The space station we would design today would be much bigger, have a lot more experimental area. And if we were spending that same amount of money, we would get more science. We'd get a lot more work out of it. So it's that, do we keep doing the thing we're doing, or do we say, hey, we're either going to deorbit or go to private enterprise on it? People are like, no, if we deorbit it, whatever, we lose our presence in space. And it's like, we're cannibalizing a much bigger, better future, in my opinion. Assuming that finances are limited, that there's X amount of money to spend, and that's the way you have to look at these things. Because it frustrates me, because you'll hear arguments like, you know, like, oh, if we spent more money, like, hey, I'm all for bigger budgets, but let's spend the money we have smarter which we see that we're not doing that right now. You know, in my opinion, I think SLS is a neat idea, but
it makes me think about, Peter Diamandis' book, Bold, where it's like, if you're building a new company, plan on hard drive space being free, plan on processing being free, plan on the price of figure out what is trending down. And it's like, okay, if getting to orbit was free, would you spend $2 billion a year on this, or would you invest it on something bigger, better, newer?
Well, Still at Work here points out, says, and this is, the three big Falcon rocket flights could lift the same mass as the entire International Space Station.
Wow. Okay.
And you can, and utilizing technology like we talked, the inflatable habitats, other stuff, composites, materials like this, we have composite material we did not have in the 90s, okay? We have much larger payload volumes we could do. We could build the really cool space station. We could build spinning space stations. That's a possibility. Hard to do it with the existing ISS thing because to make it work with that infrastructure, whatever, it's problematic. And, I'm of the opinion of like, hey, that was great. If the money is not increasing, then let's use the money for contracting Blue Origin, SpaceX to do, supply cargo missions, help build the stuff. Let's go to Bigelow and other people. There are other companies out there too that have plans. There's another guy, the former guy was the former International Space Station manager, the guy that was in charge of operating. He's got a private company now, and they're like, they have their own module they want to put up there. But that module could plug into a lot of places. So anyhow, it's a lot of it. There's a lot of great hardware, docking things. There's a lot of tech up there. Again, it's valuable, but in a day and age now where it's becoming super cheap to put stuff up there, when they built the space station, it cost $20,000 per pound to put something in orbit.
Yeah.
With the BFR, you're talking $50 per pound, $40 per pound.
I don't know how much you got on you.
Yeah.
That'll we got get a little you extra a lot room.
Space station.
By the way, we take Venmo.
Yep. And I have an attachment too, because I work with James Randi, helped develop an experiment that was on board the International Space Station, and so I feel a little kinship, a little bit attachment to that thing.
Yeah, keep it around, put a plaque on it and say, hey, remember this? That was pretty cool.
Yeah, put a plaque on some dust. Are any dissenting opinions or other thoughts?
No, man. The biggest surprise to me was just how savvy SpaceX has been when it comes to the media for all that stuff. That presentation was tight and powerful and moving and super good.
I wasn't tight. It was the greatest demonstration of space I've ever seen. And you could make an argument that has ever, since the moon landing, right? Like, when is the last time that more people got what this meant, right?
Can I tell you the really weird part was, for days afterwards, I would casually ask, you watch that launch? And they were like, no, what? And then I was astonished at how many people still don't even know that recovering the first stages is a thing. And then you show them the footage and they're like, well, would you look at that? When did that start happening?
Yeah.
Which means, maybe we just live in a bit of a bubble.
Well, look, it's, this is a thing that you have to be focused on this area, I think, for the mainstream to understand it. But at the same time, this was front page news. If there were still such things as front pages of newspapers, but this was lead image, key image news all over the world. And again, it's like there's no refuting it, unless you want to go full tinfoil hat and say it was all faked. But other than that, it's like, this is just the future, and the future builds from here in a way that we have not had, unless you're nerds like us and you've been watching this from its infancy, that we have not had on a mainstream level.
Yeah, there was a lot of attention for the last shuttle flight. I didn't watch it live because it's like, we've been launching shuttles for 30 years. So I was like, all right. There's a lot of attention on that. The last time I remember being kind of really riveted to the screen, I remember watching, it was Curiosity when they did that with the sky crane. That was cool. When Sojourner, the rover, landed in 1997, that was pretty cool. That was a really sweet moment. The first shuttle launch was cool, 1981. If you're old enough to remember the most horrific school assembly ever in 1986, That's where kids were gathered around the country into auditoriums to watch TV screens where they were going to put a teacher into space.
Oh, geez.
And it's one of those things, like, Brian, you notice, like, a lot of people don't talk about that. People don't talk about the worst school assembly ever that was shared collectively across every school kid of that age. You know, people just don't sort of, it's like, oh, yeah. You
know, I didn't see it live when it happened, so I didn't see the melt. Like, I heard about it. I guess it's like the JFK assassination. You just, you know, somebody came in and told the story, and then you went home and watched Tom Brokaw explain the tragedy. Was the way I experienced it.
Well, if you're a kid in Florida and went to school.
Oh boy.
Yeah. Anyhow, we're going to turn off the TV now, kids. I'm like, what happened? Hey, let's go to recess.
Recess, double lunch.
Yay. And you can use whatever swear word you want. It's fine.
It's a special day.
Yeah. I think as far as events, like, this felt like the most zeitgeisty kind of thing. And I think that we're watching this thing move when astronauts go on board the crew capsules and both Boeing and SpaceX's. That'll be big. It'll be exciting, but it'll look like old school rockets to a degree. So it'll be like, oh, cool. All right. Then yay, we're doing this. When the BFR starts testing, we're watching that big Falcon spaceship, just watching that test and launch from a launch pad and go up and then come back down. That will look like rockets. That will look like the future. I think that's going to be an exciting moment, because then you're going to see the size of this thing, and it's going to be, you know.
Yeah.
Overwhelming.
Hey, man, I know you have a hard out. Do you want to jump into picks real quick?
Yeah, let's jump into picks.
What you got, Andrew?
Me? My pick is I on the airplane. One, I had a delightful conversation, by the way, on the way back with a gentleman who was actually South African businessman, owned a bunch of different companies and stuff. And it was just a, you know, kind of a neat conversation about what happened and sort of remarking upon how cool things are today and age. But on the way to Florida for the launch, I played the game, and it's the room Old Sins. Right. Which is, I guess, the fourth one. Fantastic. I loved it. It's a puzzle thing. Really, really cool puzzles. I thought it was very clear. I think the one before it, I'm like, I don't quite know if I get the storyline, and I'm a little confused here. This one was a very, very cool puzzler. They did really clever stuff, beautiful visuals, great, great soundtrack, whatever. Thoroughly, thoroughly enjoyed it. It was like $5, whatever. Great. Well spent. So, yeah, that's my pick.
Awesome.
That is awesome. I got two picks. I watched a stupid and futile gesture. Was that in?
Oh, cool.
Yeah, great. I really liked it. I mean, I'm a huge fan of David Wayne's work. I love Will Forte. And then reading more. I had not seen the documentary, but reading more about the situation in that life. I went in totally clean, and I don't want to give stuff away, but I was thoroughly engrossed by the ending.
There's an acknowledged plot device that surprised me as well when I saw that.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. Me too. And it's funny, because there's a conversation I have after we said it, where I'm like, I had this whole moment of, huh, why is blank blank blank, and then nah, I'm wrong, and then. Watching the whole thing, and then, you know,
and you're like, oh, well, now that makes sense.
Yeah,
it was just this.
I was like, man, the National Lampoon guy was on Roseanne. Like, I just assumed it was like that was the thing, and it wasn't until I read about more about it that I kind of got the fuller picture. It is so fun and such a great kind of. Take chances sort of biopic that is seemingly very true to the life of Doug Kenny, and was just so fun, and just also just such a great time to see so many talented actors do their impressions of other insanely famous people, just steering into the skid of like, well, what are we gonna do, have new actors pretend to be these famous comedy icons at the height of their popularity doing the bits that they were doing. And it's like, yeah, that's exactly what we're going to do. So go ahead, God, who was the guy who played Chevy Chase?
The soup.
Joel McHale.
Yeah.
Joel McHale.
Yeah, no. Joel McHale, just do your best Chevy Chase impression. Like, one of the most iconic, like, comedic icons of all time. So that was great. And the other one is I watched the first episode of Altered Carbon, which I'm very curious to see where it goes. But, man, that show is just, like, you know, like some sci-fi shows are like, oh, this is like about stuff. And this is really like, this could be like Battlestar Galactica. That could be on a submarine, right? This one is just like sci-fi on sci-fi on sci-fi on sci-fi. It's just a 7-layer dip. And I don't know if it has any nutritional value, but if you like sci-fi tropes, like, guess what? You are getting all of them at once.
Yeah, man. The whole time it felt like the living realization of a Peter F. Hamilton novel. I mean, I really liked the world that they created. I liked the depth and the strange nooks and crannies that they were putting in. The idea that we follow an artificially intelligent bot of Edgar Allan Poe as he argues with other AIs around the poker table about his merits and demerits. I mean, it's amazing.
Yeah, I've only seen the first episode.
So yeah, I mean, it's like the opening scene of the second episode.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
No, I know. Yeah, I liked what I saw, but definitely it is more on the like space gun ray man and the hidden dimensions of Mars kind of like pulp sci-fi.
Hey, man, I got a self-serving pick. We've got daily articles every single weekday at themodernrogue.com. They're stuff that hopefully will make you the most interesting person in the room. You'll learn about everything from 5 ridiculous cyber crimes you won't believe were pulled off to my favorite was on Friday, this ridiculous secrets from the CIA's Handbook of Trickery and Deception. I read it like 15 years ago, and I generally liked it. It was interesting to see a magician who was being paid to teach how to slip Mickeys and do sleight of hand to poison people to the CIA. But in this article, our intrepid researchers picked out the stuff that is dumb as garbage in that book. And it's really fun to read. I think you guys are going to love them. We're going to start banging the drum really hard on all of the content on there, but I didn't want to start doing that until we had enough content to show off. And now with a couple dozen articles, there's lots to enjoy at themodernrogue.com.
Awesome. And it's not too late for Valentine's Day to get a gift certificate if you want.
For what?
Modern Rogue.
Of course. Yes. That lovely tradition of get a lockpick.
Scam stuff. I mean, the scam stuff gift certificate. gentlemen, this has been fun. Let's do this all again next week. Oh, Bryce, do you have any picks?
Oh, real quick. I went and saw I, Tonya on Saturday night. It was fantastic. Mm-hmm. I did not know the story of Tonya Harding or Nancy Kerrigan.
Oh, wow. Much at all. You didn't live through that. That's amazing.
Yeah. And so it was interesting to see that. And Margot Robbie was fantastic.
She's great.
All of the players were really great. If you haven't seen it, go see it now before it gets out of theaters. I, Tonya is awesome.
Wonderful. Gentlemen, I was actually just looking at the Bigelow Aerospace, looking at their inflatable habitats and stuff. I'm like, oh, cool. Now we can launch these. gentlemen, it's been weird.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.